The march was southeast out of Louisville toward Bardstown, and the army made it in three columns, a corps in each, commanded, left to right, by Alexander McCook, T.L. Crittenden, and Charles Gilbert. Bragg was in that direction, Smith at Frankfort. Buell figured his chances were good if he could keep them divided and thus encounter them one at a time. Less good, in fact not good at all, if he had to face them both at once. So he feinted toward the latter place with a division detached from McCook, supported by the large 15,000-man 10th Division, composed almost entirely of recruits under Brigadier General Ebenezer Dumont. That way, Buell would not only cover Louisville, but also, by confusing his opponents as to his true objective, he might keep them from combining against him in the battle he was seeking at last. After 4 months of building and repairing roads and railroads, tediously advancing and hastily backtracking, enduring constant prodding from above, he was about to fight. Down in Mississippi all this while, Van Dorn and Price had been pursuing separate courses, neither of which had produced anything substantial even in the way of a diversion. Not only were they independent of each other, Van Dorn was also independent of Bragg, and now that he and Isaac Brown had accomplished the salvation of Vicksburg, the diminutive Mississippian had larger things in mind than keeping Grant amused along the lower Tennessee border while Bragg got all the glory in Kentucky. After the loss of the Arkansas and Breckinridge's repulse at Baton Rouge, Van Dorn had abandoned his "ho for New Orleans" notion and shifted his gaze upriver, reverting to his earlier slogan, "St. Louis, then huzzah!" His plan was to swing through West Tennessee, skirting Memphis, to pounce on Paducah, from which point he would move wherever circumstances might dictate. So when Price, mindful of Bragg's instructions to harry the Federals in North Mississippi, called on his former chief for aid, Van Dorn replied that he would rather have Price join him. Price declined. Nettled, Van Dorn invoked his seniority and appealed directly to the Secretary of War. "I ought to have command of the movements of Price, that there may be concert of action. Bragg is out of reach. I refer to you." Davis himself wired back, "Your rank makes you the commander, and such, I supposed, were the instructions of General Bragg." Van Dorn had what he wanted, but Price had already moved on his own, striking for Iuka, 20-odd miles down the Memphis and Charleston Railroad from Corinth, the fortified eastern anchor of Grant's contracted line. September 14th, as Price's nearly 15,000 troops approached, the badly outnumbered Union garrison retreated in haste, leaving a quantity of confiscated cotton and army stores behind. Price burned the one and appropriated the other. It was now his intention to march on Middle Tennessee, to which Bragg informed him the Federals were retiring, but finding that this was not entirely the case, that Grant, though he had sent three of his five left-flank divisions to Buell, still had the other two near Iuka, under Rosecrans, he hesitated to leave such a substantial force in his rear. While he was pondering this dilemma and distributing the captured stores, the problem was solved by the arrival of a courier from Van Dorn's headquarters at Holly Springs, 60 miles west of Corinth, informing Price that the President had authorized his fellow Mississippian to order a junction of the two armies under his command for whatever concert of action he had in mind. The Missourian's intention was to stay in Iuka until he heard from Van Dorn just what it was he wanted him to do. Then he would move out, more or less at his leisure, in whatever direction Van Dorn advised in order to combine the two commands for a resumption of the offensive. However, this was overlooking Grant's plans in the matter, and Grant intended not only to interrupt Price's leisure, but also to destroy him. In fact, he said later, "It looked to me that if Price would remain in Iuka until we could get there, his annihilation was inevitable." By "we," he meant himself and Rosecrans, whose two divisions contained about 9,000 effectives, and he also meant Ord, who would advance from Corinth with another two divisions, leaving a strong garrison to man the fortifications in case Van Dorn pushed east from Holly Springs for an assault while he was gone. Price had 15,000 men. Rosecrans and Ord had 17,000 between them. This in itself was by no means enough of a preponderance to assure the annihilation Grant expected, but he had designed a tactical convergence to accomplish that result. Ord would swing north and descend on Iuka from that direction, while Rosecrans came up from the south. Once Price had his attention thoroughly fixed on the former, the latter would fall on his rear, so that the rebels, demoralized and cut off from all avenues of escape, would have to choose between death and capitulation. Advised of the plan, both of Grant's subordinate commanders were as optimistic as their chief, though Rosecrans warned, "Price is an old woodpecker," meaning that he would be hard to take by surprise. Accordingly, on September 17th, while Lee, with his back to the Potomac, was defending Sharpsburg against McClellan, and Wilder, with his back to the Green, was surrendering Munfordville to Bragg, Ord moved 12 miles down the Memphis and Charleston to Burnsville, where Grant established headquarters, having instructed Rosecrans to concentrate at Jacinto, 8 miles south. From these two points, the four divisions were to push on to within striking distance of Iuka the following day in order to deliver their sequential north-south attacks soon after dawn of the 19th. But that was not to be. Rosecrans reported that one of his divisions had been so badly delayed that he could not be in position before mid-afternoon of the appointed day. Ord moved up on schedule, however, establishing contact with the Confederate cavalry outposts, and Grant used the waiting time to engage in a bit of psychological warfare. Last night he had received from the telegraph superintendent at Cairo a dispatch concerning the Battle of Antietam. According to this gentleman, the news was very good indeed. Both sides engaged until 4 p.m., at which time Hooker gained position, flanked rebels, and threw them into disorder. Longstreet and his entire division prisoners, General Hill killed, entire rebel army of Virginia destroyed, Burnside having reoccupied Harper's Ferry and cut off retreat. Latest advices say entire rebel army must be captured or killed, as Potomac is rising and our forces pressing the enemy continually. Grant sent the message forward to Ord, who passed it on to the Confederates this morning under a flag of truce. "I think this battle decides the war finally," he explained in a covering note, "and that upon being satisfied of its truth, General Price, or whoever commands here, will avoid useless bloodshed and lay down his arms. There is not the slightest doubt of the truth of the dispatch in my hand." The reply was prompt. Formally employing the third person, Price said flatly that he did not believe the report was true, but that if the facts were as stated in those dispatches, they would only move him and his soldiers to greater exertions in behalf of their country, and that neither he nor they will ever lay down their arms, as humanely suggested by General Ord, until the independence of the Confederate States shall have been acknowledged by the United States. Psychological warfare having failed to produce the desired result, Grant told Ord to go ahead with the opening phase, diverting Price's attention northward, though he warned, "Rosecrans is behind where we expected. Do not be too rapid in your advance, unless it should be found that the enemy are evacuating." Ord moved forward, encountering light resistance, but since there was still no word that the southward escape route was blocked, Grant told him to halt within 4 miles of the town, and there await the sounds of an engagement between Rosecrans and the enemy before engaging the latter. Ord did so, and the afternoon wore on. About 6 o'clock, he received a message written 2 hours before by the commander of his lead division. "For the last 20 minutes there has been a dense smoke arising from the direction of Iuka. I conclude that the enemy are evacuating and destroying the stores." Ord pushed forward, tentatively, but still hearing no sound of conflict from the south, halted his troops in line of battle, and there they remained through twilight into darkness, a northwest wind blowing hard against their backs. His total loss for the day in both divisions was 1 man wounded. The smoke had been beyond, not in the town, and it came from Price's guns, not his stores. Just as Grant had intended, the old woodpecker had concentrated northward against Ord, but about 2 o'clock, learning that another Union column was approaching from the south, he shifted one brigade in that direction and presently followed it with another. Soon afterwards, since Ord seemed disinclined to press the issue, he called for a third. Before it got there, the fight with Rosecrans had begun. Seeing the lead Blue Division waver, Price ordered a charge that drove the Federals back on their supports and captured 9 of their guns. Upwind, Ord heard nothing. Grant, in fact, did not suspect that his other column was at hand until next morning, when he received a note Rosecrans had written the night before. Headed 2 miles south of Iuka, it reported that he had met the enemy in force just above this point. The ground is horrid, unknown to us, and no room for development. Push on into them until we can have time to do something. The convergence, though delayed, had worked exactly as Grant planned it, but instead of producing a victory as expected, had resulted in a repulse, which, though it cost him 9 guns and nearly 800 soldiers, gained him nothing. An ill wind had blown no good, but now at least he knew he had both of his columns in position, north and south of the town, ready to put the squeeze on Price, who was boxed in. Or so Grant thought when he told Ord at 8:35 that morning, "Get your troops up and attack as soon as possible." Ord did so, banging away with his guns as he advanced, and so did Rosecrans, only to find that they were converging on emptiness. Price, whose wagons had been packed for the move before the Federals appeared, had evacuated Iuka during the night, taking a southeast road which Rosecrans left unguarded. At Grant's insistence, the latter took up the pursuit, hoping at least to recapture the stores being hauled away, but abandoned it when he ran into an ambush 8 miles out. All Grant's strategic pains had netted him was an empty town and the task of burying the dead of both armies. Rosecrans had lost 790 men, Price 535, and the latter had gotten away with all his spoils. Ord, meanwhile, was hurrying back west by rail in case Van Dorn had left Holly Springs and crossed the Hatchie River for a leap at Corinth. The prospect of this held no dismay for Rosecrans. In fact, he welcomed it. Whatever blunders he had committed against Price, he looked forward to a contest with Van Dorn. They had been classmates, West Point, 56. He had finished 4th from the top, the Southerner 4th from the bottom. And Rosecrans was eager to extend this proof of his superiority beyond the academic. Back at Jacinto that night, he wired Grant, "If you can let me know that there is a good opportunity to cross the railroad and march on Holly Springs to cut off the forces of Buck Van Dorn, I will be in readiness to take everything. If we could get them across the Hatchie, they would be clean up the spout." He was about to be accommodated in his desire for a bloody reunion east of the Hatchie, although not in the manner he imagined, since it would involve a change of roles. Instead of the hunter, he would be the hunted. Van Dorn had set aside the elaborate scheme for a march on Paducah, which would expose both of his flanks to attack by superior numbers, and had decided to precede it with a much simpler, though in its way no less daring, operation. He was planning a direct assault on Corinth. That place, he saw now, was the linchpin of the Federal defenses in North Mississippi. Once it was cracked and unseated, he could move at will on Memphis, or he could revert to his earlier plan for a march on St. Louis, gobbling up Blue detachments as he went. "We may take them in detail if they are not wary," he explained in a dispatch that reached Price the day before the Battle of Iuka. "But once combined, we will make a successful campaign, clear out West Tennessee, and then..." His new plan, outlined in this and other messages written after Price's hairbreadth escape from Iuka with the aid of a friendly wind, was for their two commands to unite at Ripley, just west of the Hatchie, then move north up that bank of the river, as if against Bolivar. However, this would only be a feint, serving to immobilize Grant's reserve force under Hurlbut at that point. When they reached the Memphis and Charleston at Pocahontas, they would turn sharp right and drive for Corinth, 20 miles away, blocking the path of reinforcements from the northwest, and striking before Rosecrans had time to bring in troops from the east for its defense. Combined, Van Dorn and Price had 22,000 men, while in Corinth, the former explained, there were no more than 15,000, the rest, about 8,000, being posted out toward Burnsville and Jacinto, guarding against attack from that direction. These odds, he said, gave him a reasonable hope of success in driving the defenders from their guns and entrenchments and capturing the lot, together with the supplies being collected for an advance. Price, who had been associated with the Mississippian in a similar venture against Curtis 7 months before in the wilds of Arkansas, with results barely short of disastrous, was not so sure, but at any rate, after 8 weeks of being hamstrung by conflicting orders and exposed to ridicule, he was glad to be doing something. Back in his home state, the 290-pound Missourian had been nicknamed Old Skedad by Unionist editors, one of whom remarked that, as a racer, he has seen few equals for his weight. To cap the climax, rumors had been spread that he was a West Pointer. After these and other such vexations, although the educational slander was promptly refuted by a friendly correspondent who assured the public that Price owes his success to practical good sense and hard fighting, he never attended a military school in his life, he was glad of a chance to move against the enemy, even though Van Dorn himself, sanguine as he was by nature, characterized their hope of success as no more than reasonable. Accordingly, both commands reached Ripley on September 28th. Van Dorn's one division, under Mansfield Lovell, who, like his chief, was out to redeem misfortune, New Orleans bulking even larger in this respect than Elkhorn Tavern, and Price's two under Brigadier Generals Dabney Maury and Louis Hebert. Lovell began the northward march that afternoon, followed by Maury and Hebert the next morning. They had 50 miles to go, 30 up to Pocahontas, then 20 down to Corinth, all along a single narrow road through densely wooded country, bone dry after the summer-long drought. The final lap would be the hardest, not only because it called for speed and accurate timing to achieve concerted action and surprise, but also because after they crossed the Hatchie there would be no water until they reached Corinth, where they would have to fight for it and win or else go thirsty. Nevertheless, according to Van Dorn, the troops were in fine spirits, and the whole Army of West Tennessee, so he called it, anticipating the movement which would follow victory, seemed eager to emulate the armies of the Potomac and of Kentucky. Like their leaders, the soldiers were out to undo past reverses. Van Dorn himself reported, "No army ever marched to battle with prouder steps, more hopeful countenances, or with more courage." October 1st, the van approached Pocahontas and, ending the feint at Bolivar, swung east, encountering cavalry here and infantry the following day at Chihuahua, 10 miles short of Corinth. Van Dorn knew that whatever the element of secrecy could accomplish was behind him. From here on in, Rosecrans was forewarned. The Confederates pressed on, skirmishing as they advanced, and next morning, October 3rd, 2 miles short of their objective, came upon a heavy line of Federal infantry occupying the entrenchments Beauregard, and incidentally Van Dorn himself, had dug along the Crescent Ridge to hold off Halleck back in May. Unlike Halleck, the Mississippian put his troops into assault formation and sent them forward without delay, Lovell on the right astride the Memphis and Charleston, and Maury and Hebert beyond him reaching over to the Mobile and Ohio, so that as they moved east and south, the three divisions would converge on the crossing. Whooping, the Graybacks started up the ridge after the Bluecoats firing down at them from the crest, and that was the beginning of what turned out to be a 2-day battle which was one of the most violent of the war. The reason it stretched to 2 days, despite its having been designed as a slashing attack that would crumple in a matter of hours whatever stood in its path, was that Rosecrans was not only braced for the shock, but actually outnumbered his assailants. For the wrong reasons, he had done the right things. and what was more, he had done them mostly on his own. Grant, following the post-Donelson pattern, the Shiloh pattern, too, for that matter, had gone off to St. Louis to confer with Curtis about the possibility of bringing reinforcements across the river from Helena, and, failing in this, had not returned to his headquarters at Jackson, Tennessee, until Van Dorn and Price had already begun their northward march out of Ripley. Supposing, as Van Dorn intended for him to suppose, that the rebels were moving against Hurlbut at Bolivar, Rosecrans reacted in a fashion which his opponent had not foreseen. That is, he called in his troops from Burnsville and Jacinto, two full divisions of them, and prepared to go to Hurlbut's assistance, so that when the Confederates swung east at Pocahontas, ending their feint and driving hard in his direction, the Corinth commander was ready for them. Instead of catching 15,000 Federals unaware, Van Dorn and his 22,000 were moving against an army which had not only been consolidated, but also in fact outnumbered his own by more than 1,000 men. As if this was not advantage enough, Rosecrans had his four divisions posted behind a formidable double line of entrenchments. Three were thrust forward along the northward ridge, where Beauregard had done their digging for them, and one was held in reserve to man the works recently constructed along the northern and western perimeter of the town itself. Van Dorn and Price struck hard, advancing with thirsty desperation. The Confederates threw the defenders off the outer ridge soon after midday, taking several pieces of artillery in the process. But the Federals were stubborn, yielding each to only the heaviest pressure. They took up four separate positions between the two fortified lines. The sun was near the land line, and the attackers were near exhaustion by the time they came within musket range of the gun-bristled outskirts of Corinth. Regretfully, while his men dispersed to draw water from the captured Union wells, Van Dorn deferred the coup de grace, or anyhow what he conceived as such, till morning. Losses on both sides had been heavy. Rosecrans, though he was later to claim, like Van Dorn, that another hour of daylight would have meant victory on the first day of battle, was thankful for the respite. That morning, with the graybacks bearing down on him, he had complained to Grant at Jackson, "Our men did not act or fight well." Now, though, he felt better. "If they fight us tomorrow," he wired Grant half an hour before midnight, "I think we shall whip them." Then, bethinking himself of the unpredictable nature of his classmate, Buck Van Dorn, he added, "If they go to attack you, we shall advance upon them." Van Dorn, however, was through with trickery, double envelopments, and the like, at least for the present. His blood was up. It was Rosecrans he was after, and he was after him in the harshest, most straightforward way imaginable. Today he would depend not on deception to complete the destruction begun the day before, but on the rapid point-blank fire of his guns and the naked valor of his infantry. Before dawn, October 4th, his artillery opened on the Federal inner line, which was prompt in reply. It was grand, one Union brigadier declared. The different calibers, metals, shapes, and distances of the guns caused the sounds to resemble the chimes of old Rome when all her bells rang out. This continued until after sunrise, when a long lull succeeded the uproar, punctuated by sharpshooters banging away at whatever showed ahead. Rosecrans was curious but cautious, wondering what was afoot out there beyond the screen of trees. "Feel them," he told one regimental commander, "but don't get into their fingers." "I'll feel them," the colonel said, and led a sally. Entering the woods, the regiment was received with a crash of musketry and fell back, badly cut up, its colonel having been shot through the neck and captured. All that Rosecrans learned from this was that Van Dorn was still there in strength. Shortly after 10 o'clock, he received even more emphatic proof that this was the case, for at that hour Van Dorn launched his all-or-nothing assault. Price's two divisions began it, surging forward in echelon to be met with a blast of cannon fire. The left elements suffered a sudden and bloody repulse, but three regiments in the center achieved a breakthrough when the Union cannoneers fell back from their guns in a panic that spread to the supporting infantry. Yelling men in Butternut burst into the streets of Corinth, driving snipers out of houses by firing through the windows, swept past Rosecrans's deserted headquarters, and onto the depot beyond the railroad crossing. At that point, however, finding their advance unsupported and the Federals standing firm, they turned and fought their way back out again. On the far right, pinned down by heavy fire from a ridge to its immediate front, Lovell's division gained no ground at all. The day was hot, 94 degrees in the shade. Panting and thirsty, the attackers hugged what cover they could find. From time to time they would rise and charge, urged on by their officers, but after the original short-lived penetration they had no luck at all. The Bluecoats stood firm. "Our lines melted under their fire like snow in thaw," one Confederate afterwards recalled. Perhaps the hardest fighting of the day occurred in front of Battery Robinette, just north of the Memphis and Charleston Railroad. A 3-gun redan protected by a 5-foot ditch which overflowed with dead and dying Texans and Arkansans within 2 hours. By then it was noon, and Van Dorn knew his long-shot gamble had failed. Exhausted from loss of sleep, wearied from hard marching and fighting, companies and regiments without officers, he later reported, "our troops, let no one censure them, gave way. The day was lost." How lost it was he would not know until he counted the casualties he had suffered and weighed them against the number he had inflicted. 4,233 Confederates, as compared to 2,520 Federals, with well over 1/3 of the former listed as missing. Price wept as he watched his thinned ranks withdraw, the men's faces sullen with the knowledge that hard fighting had won them nothing more than the right to stitch the name of another defeat on their battle flags. By 1 o'clock they were in full retreat, unpursued. Instead of pressing their rear, Rosecrans was riding along his battered line to deny in person a rumor that he had been slain. "Old Rosie," his men called him, a red-faced man in his middle 40s with the profile of a Roman orator. At Battery Robinette he drew rein, dismounted, bared his head, and told his soldiers, most of whom were Ohioans like himself, "I stand in the presence of brave men, and I take my hat off to you." Van Dorn, meanwhile, had stopped for the night at Chawala, from which he had launched his first attack the day before. Next morning, finding the Hatchie Crossing blocked by 8,000 fresh troops sent down from Bolivar, he fought a holding action in which about 600 men fell on each side, then turned back south and crossed by a road leading west out of Corinth, which Rosecrans, as at Iuka, had left open. Stung into vigor, old Rosie at last took up the pursuit, complaining bitterly when Grant called him off. Van Dorn returned to Holly Springs by way of Ripley, accompanied by Price. The brief, vicious campaign was over. What had been intended as a third prong in the South's late summer, early fall offensive had snapped off short as soon as it was launched. Including the holding action on the Hatchie, it had gained the Confederacy nothing except the infliction of just over 3,000 casualties on the Federals in North Mississippi. And for this Van Dorn had paid with nearly 5,000 of his own. A cry went up that the nation could no longer afford to pay in blood for the failure of his thick-skulled fights and hare-brained maneuvers. Nor were the protests limited in reference to his military judgment. The man himself was under fire. "He is regarded as the source of all our woes," a senator from his native state complained, "and disaster, it is prophesied, will attend us so long as he is connected with this army. The atmosphere is dense with horrid narratives of his negligence, whoring, and drunkenness, for the truth of which I cannot vouch, but it is so fastened in the public belief that an acquittal by a court-martial of angels would not relieve him of the charge." These and other allegations, specifically that he had been drunk on duty at Corinth, that he had neglected his wounded on the retreat, and that he had failed to provide himself with a map of the country, resulted in a court of inquiry, called for by the accused himself. The court, by a unanimous decision, cleared him of all blame, adding that the charges are not only not proved, but they are disproved. Thus were Van Dorn's critics officially answered and rebuked. However, the best answer, although unofficial, had already been made for him on the field of battle itself, shortly after his departure. Near Battery Robinette, having bared his head in the presence of brave men, Rosecrans came upon an Arkansas lieutenant, shot through the foot and propped against a tree. He offered him a drink of water. "Thank you, General. One of your men just gave me some," the Confederate replied. When the Federal commander, glancing around at the heaped and scattered corpses in their butternut rags, remarked that there had been pretty hot fighting here, the rebel Westerner agreed. "Yes, General, you licked us good," he said. "But we gave you the best we had in the ranch." The best they had was not enough. But even if it had served the Mississippi General's purpose, it would have been of small help to Bragg, 300 airline miles northeastward in Kentucky. At the same hour of the same day that Van Dorn broke off the fight at Corinth and retreated, 1 p.m. October 4th, the boom of Union guns lobbing shells into the outskirts of Frankfort disrupted the inaugural ceremonies and ended in mid-sentence the address being delivered by Confederate Governor Hawes, who had been sworn in at high noon and whose de facto tenure of office thus was brief. Despite a shortage of cavalry for outpost work and scouting, Forrest had been sent back to Middle Tennessee to raise another new brigade, and John Morgan was off chasing his federal namesake across the barrens. Bragg was not entirely surprised at this development, nor was he in any sense dismayed. In fact, having been forewarned, he had expressed the hope that Buell would attempt just such a maneuver. Informed 2 days before, October 2nd, that a blue column was moving east from Louisville toward Shelbyville and Frankfort, he passed the word along to Polk, whom he had left in command of the four divisions around Bardstown, while he himself joined Kirby Smith to attend the inauguration at the Capitol. "It may be a reconnaissance," he added, "but should it be a real attack, we have them. With Smith in front and our gallant army on the flank, I see no hope for Buell if he is rash enough to come out. I only fear it is not true. Hold yourself informed by scouts toward Shelbyville, and if you discover a heavy force that has moved on Frankfort, strike without further orders." A few hours later, more positive evidence was at hand, and Bragg followed this first message with a second. "The enemy is certainly advancing on Frankfort. Put your whole available force in motion and strike him in flank and rear. If we can combine our movements, he is certainly lost." Couriers taking these messages to Bardstown, Pennsylvania's Stephen Foster's old Kentucky home, passed en route a courier bringing a dispatch Polk had written that same morning. He too was being advanced on, he declared, not by a single federal column, but by three, all moving southeast out of Louisville on as many different roads. His original instructions, in the event that he was menaced by a superior force, had been to fall back eastward. Accordingly, he told Bragg, "I shall keep the enemy well under observation, and my action shall be governed by the circumstances which shall be developed. If an opportunity presents itself, I will strike. If it shall be clearly inexpedient to do that, I will, according to your suggestion, fall back on Harrodsburg and Danville on the roads indicated by you, with a view to a concentration of both armies." Pointedly, he observed in closing, "It seems to me we are too much scattered." Next morning, October 3rd, having received Bragg's two messages of the day before, instructing him to strike the flank and rear of the column moving against Frankfort, he replied, "The last 24 hours have developed a condition of things on my front and left flank which I shadowed forth in my last note to you, which makes compliance with this order not only eminently inexpedient but impractical. I have called a conference of wing and division commanders, to whom I have submitted the matter, and find that they unanimously endorse my views of what is demanded. I shall therefore pursue a different course, assured that when facts are submitted to you, you will justify my decision." Reverting to his original instructions to fall back eastward, he added, "The head of my column will move this evening." Bragg concurred, at least for the time being, receiving Polk's dispatch at Frankfurt during the early hours of Inauguration Day, he replied, "Concentrate your force in front of Harrodsburg. Smith's whole force is concentrating here, and we will strike the enemy just as soon as we can concentrate." Mindful of the effect the retrograde movement might have on the troops, he admonished the Bishop General, "Keep the men in heart by assuring them it is not a retreat but a concentration for a fight. We can and must defeat them." Near midday he followed this with further assurance, "We shall put our governor in power soon, and then I propose to seek the enemy." Just then, however, the ceremony was interrupted by the boom of guns. The enemy, it appeared, had sought him, so Bragg tacked a postscript on the message. 1:30 p.m., enemy in heavy force advancing on us, only 12 miles out, shall destroy bridges and retire on Harrodsburg for concentration and then strike. Reach that point as soon as possible. Throughout the greater part of this exchange, despite the sudden and apparently unpremeditated changes of decision and direction, which came full circle and brought him back to the start before the finish, Bragg had given an effective imitation of a man who not only knew where he was going, but also knew what he was going to do when he got there. Concentrate and strike were the predominant verbs, especially the former. But the truth was, he was badly confused, whether he knew it or not. Buell's feint toward Frankfurt, led by Brigadier General Joshua Sill's division and supported by the oversized division of Green men under Dumont, succeeded admirably. Bragg, being directly confronted, considered this the major Federal effort and, discounting Polk's specific warning to the contrary, underrated the strength of the Three Corps column moving down toward Bardstown. Not that Buell himself had no problems, though his army was large, 55,000 soldiers in one column, 22,000 in the other. The former alone was larger than Bragg's and Smith's, even if they had been combined, which they had not. Size also had its drawbacks, particularly on the march, as he was rapidly finding out. Besides, at least 1/3 of this 77,000-man collection were recruits, so-called squirrel hunters, rallied to the call of startled governors who had suddenly found the war approaching their Ohio River doorsteps. A gloomy-minded general, and Buell was certainly that, would be inclined to suppose that such troops had established their all-time pattern of behavior at the Battle of Richmond, 5 short weeks ago, in which case, panic being highly contagious in combat, they were likely to prove more of a liability than an asset. Nor was this inexperience limited to the ranks. The corps commanders themselves, raised to their present positions during the hasty reorganization at Louisville the week before, were doubtful quantities at best, untested by the pressure of command responsibility in battle. Crittenden had dignity, but according to a correspondent who knew and respected him, his talents were mainly those of a country lawyer. In his favor was a fervid devotion to the Union, no doubt intensified by the fact that his brother had chosen the opposite side. McCook, on the other hand, was an overgrown schoolboy, according to the same reporter. Barely 31, he had a rollicking manner and was something of a wag, and as such he irritated more often than he cheered. By all odds, however, the strangest of the three, at least in the method by which he had arrived at his present eminence, was Gilbert. A regular army captain of infantry, he had happened to be in Louisville when Bragg started north, and the department commander at Cincinnati, alarmed and badly in need of professional help, issued the order, "Captain C.C. Gilbert, 1st Infantry U.S. Army, is hereby appointed a Major General of Volunteers, subject to the approval of the President of the United States." Lincoln in time appointed him a brigadier, subject to confirmation by Congress, which decided after some debate that he was only a captain after all. For the present, though, he was apparently a bona fide major general, and as such he received the corps command to which his rank entitled him. These, then, were the troops with which Buell was expected to fling Bragg's and Smith's veterans out of Kentucky, and these were the ranking officers on whom he depended for execution of his orders. In partial compensation there was Thomas, but old Pap, as he was coming to be called, had never been one to offer unsolicited advice. Officially designated as second in command of the whole army, for the present he was riding with Crittenden's column as a sort of super corps commander. This arrangement not only placed Buell's most competent subordinate in a superfluous position and beyond his immediate reach, but what was more, it led in time to trouble. The Confederates having evacuated Bardstown on the 4th, the Federals entered or bypassed the place that evening and slogged on down the dusty roads toward Mackville, Springfield, and Lebanon, encountering only rebel horsemen who faded back whenever contact was established. This was satisfactory, but there was a disturbing lack of coordination between the three columns with which Buell was groping for Bragg as if with widespread fingers. On the left, McCook wrote Thomas, who was with Crittenden on the right, 20 miles away, "Please keep me advised of your movements so that I can cooperate. I am in blissful ignorance." Another lack was more immediately painful, at least to the marchers themselves. One Illinois volunteer later recalled that after the summer-long drought, which had stretched into fall, creeks and even rivers were either totally dry or shrunken into little heated, tired-looking threads of water, brackish and disagreeable to taste and smell. Brackish or not, water was much on the men's minds as well as on the minds of their commanders. Pushing on through Springfield, Buell ordered a concentration near Perryville on the 7th. There was water there, in Doctor's Creek, a tributary of Chaplain River, which in turn was a tributary of the Salt. There were also rebels there, or so he heard, in strength. After 4 hard months of marching hundreds of miles, sneered and sniped at by the authorities much of the time, the Army of the Ohio was about to come to grips with the gray-clad authors of its woes. They did come to grips that evening, or nearly to grips. Part of them, at any rate. McCook, coming down through Mackville, was delayed by a bad road and went into camp 8 miles short of his objective. Crittenden, coming up from Lebanon, was delayed by a detour Thomas authorized him to make in search of water. He, too, had to stop for the night, 10 miles short of the designated point of concentration. Only Gilbert's central column, trudging east from Springfield by the direct route, reached the field on schedule. His troops marched in near sundown, tired and thirsty, but found Doctor's Creek defended by snipers on a ridge across the way. Sorely in need of the water standing in pools along the creek bed, the Bluecoats launched a vigorous downhill attack. Repulsed, they fell back toward the sunset, reformed, and tried again, this time by the light of a full moon rising beyond the ridge where enemy riflemen lay concealed to catch them in their sights. Again they were repulsed. Exhausted by these added exertions and thirstier than ever, they made a dry camp in the woods, tantalized by the thought of water gleaming silver in the moonlight just ahead. It was an inauspicious beginning. What was more, Buell himself was indisposed, having been lamed and badly shaken up as a result of being thrown by a fractious horse that afternoon. But he was not discouraged. He had suffered and sweltered too much and too long all through the long summer into fall to be anything but relieved by the thought that he had Bragg's whole army at last within reach of the widespread fingers now being clenched into a fist. The feint at Frankfort having served its purpose, Sill was on the way south to rejoin McCook, who himself had only a short way left to come. Off to the southwest, Crittenden, too, was within easy marching distance. To make certain that his army was concentrated without further delay, Buell had his chief of staff send a message to Thomas, urging him to be on the road by 3 a.m. Bragg had been brought to bay at Perryville, he told him, adding, "We expect to attack and carry the place tomorrow." Buell's estimate of the enemy situation, particularly in regard to the strength of the force which had denied his men a drink from Doctor's Creek, was considerably mistaken. Bragg's whole army was not there on the opposite ridge, only a part of it was, so far only half, in fact, which in turn was the result of a mistake in the opposite direction. Still confused by the feint at Frankfort, Bragg assumed that only a part of Buell's army was approaching Perryville. And thus was achieved a curious balance of error. Buell thought he was facing Bragg's whole army, whereas it was only a part, and Bragg thought he was facing only a part of Buell's army, whereas it was, or soon would be, the whole. This compound misconception not only accounted for much of the confusion that ensued, but it was also the result of much confusion in the immediate past. At Harrodsburg that morning, Bragg had issued a confidential circular, calling for a concentration of both armies near Versailles, south of Frankfort, west of Lexington, and east of the Kentucky River. Polk was to move his two divisions there at once, joining Kirby Smith, while Hardee followed, delaying the enemy column as he fell back. It was all quite carefully worked out. Each commander was told just what to do. But no sooner was it completed than Bragg received a dispatch Polk had written late the night before, reporting that he had told Hardee to ascertain, if possible, the strength of the enemy which may be covered by his advance. I cannot think it large. Polk meant by this that he did not think the Federal covering force or advance guard was large, but Bragg took him to mean the main body. Accordingly, he decided to have Hardee give the enemy column a rap that would slow it down and afford him the leisure he needed to cross the Salt and Kentucky rivers and effect the concentration. Polk was instructed to have one of his divisions continue its march to join Smith beyond the river, but to return to Perryville with the other in order to reinforce Hardee for this purpose. "Give the enemy battle immediately," Bragg wrote. "Rout him, and then move to our support at Versailles." This was written at sundown, just as the Federals began their fight for the water west of Perryville. A copy of it reached Hardee, together with the confidential circular, just after the second repulse. The tactics author read them both, and while he approved of the circular, finding it militarily sound, he was horrified by the instructions given Polk to divide his wing and precipitate a battle in which Bragg would employ only three of the four divisions of one of the armies moving toward a proper concentration. So horrified was Hardee, in fact, by this violation of the principles he had outlined in his book on infantry tactics, that he retired at once to his tent and wrote the commanding general a personal letter of advice. "Permit me, from the friendly relations so long existing between us, to write you plainly. Do not scatter your forces. There is one rule in our profession which should never be forgotten. It is to throw the masses of your troops on the fractions of the enemy. The movement last proposed will divide your army, and each may be defeated, whereas by keeping them united, success is certain. If it be your policy to strike the enemy at Versailles, take your whole force with you and make the blow effective. If, on the contrary, you should decide to strike the army in front of me, first let that be done with a force which will make success certain. Strike with your whole strength first to the right, then to the left. I could not sleep quietly tonight without giving expression to these views. Whatever you decide to do will meet my hearty cooperation." He signed it, "Your sincere friend," then added a postscript. "If you wish my opinion, it is that in view of the position of your depots, you ought to strike this force first," and gave it to an officer courier for immediate delivery. 3 hours would suffice to bring an answer, but there was none, except that Polk arrived in the night with one division, which in itself was a sort of negative answer, and assumed command by virtue of his rank. The Confederate overall strength was 16,000 men. What the Federal strength was, neither Polk nor Hardee knew, though they suspected that it was considerably larger than their own. At earliest dawn, while they were discussing whether to attack as Bragg had ordered, Buell solved the problem for them by attacking first. Once more it was a dash for water, and this time it succeeded. Where other units had failed the night before, Brigadier General Philip H. Sheridan, commanding a division under Gilbert, went forward with one of his brigades in the gray twilight before sunrise, October 8th, and seized not only a stretch of the creek itself, with several of its precious pools of water, but also the dominant heights beyond. throwing the rebel snipers back and posting his own men along the ridge to prevent their return. A 31-year-old bandy-legged Ohioan with heavy crescent-shaped eyebrows, cropped hair, and a head as round as a pot, he looked more like a Mongolian than like the Irishman he was. Less than 10 years out of West Point, he had received his star 2 weeks ago and had been a division commander just 9 days, previous to which time he had been a commissary captain under Halleck for 6 months, until by a fluke he secured a promotion to colonel and command of a Michigan cavalry regiment, which he led with such dash in pursuit of Beauregard after the Corinth evacuation, that in late July 5 of his superiors, including Rosecrans, recommended his promotion with the endorsement, "He is worth his weight in gold." Now in Kentucky, having received his star, he was out to prove the validity of their claim, as well as his right to further advancement. Other inducements were there, too. The son of immigrant parents, born in County Cavan, some said, or en route in mid-Atlantic, according to others, though Sheridan himself denied this, not only because he was strenuously American and preferred to think of himself as having sprung from native soil, but also because he learned in time that no person who drew his first breath outside its limits could ever become President of the United States. He had an intense dislike of Southerners, particularly those with aristocratic pretensions, and had suffered a year's suspension from the academy for threatening with a bayonet a Virginia upperclassman whose tone he found offensive on the drill field. He was a man in a hurry. In addition to other provocations, real or imaginary, he felt that the South owed him repayment, preferably in blood, for the year he had lost, and this morning he began to collect in earnest. However, the fury of his attack across Doctor's Creek was apparently about as alarming to his own corps commander as it had been to the Confederates. Gilbert kept wig-wagging messages forward, imploring the young enthusiast not to bring on a general engagement contrary to Buell's wishes. Sheridan, who was up where he could see what was going on, later wrote that he replied to each message that I was not bringing on an engagement, but that the enemy evidently intended to do so, and that I believed I should shortly be attacked. Attacked, as he predicted, he brought up his other brigades and held his ground, after which a long lull ensued. Gilbert, taking heart at this, sent the other two divisions forward to take position along the ridge and astride the Springfield Road, which crossed it on the way to Perryville, just under 2 miles ahead. This done, he went to report his success to Army headquarters, 3 miles back down the road. He got there about 12:30 to find that McCook had just arrived. Much to Buell's relief, his two divisions were filing in on the Mackville Road to take position on Gilbert's left, separated from it by a quarter-mile-wide valley cradling a bend of Doctor's Creek. Within another half hour, more good news was received. Crittenden, too, was at hand, entering by the Lebanon Road and preparing to move northward up the ridge beyond the creek, taking position on Gilbert's right, and thus extending the line of battle. During these early afternoon hours, everything was falling into place, as if the pieces of an enormous jigsaw puzzle had suddenly interlocked of their own accord. A common enough phenomenon, but one that never failed to exhilarate and amaze. Except for Sill's division, which was on the way from Frankfort, and the Green division under Dumont, which was continuing the feint, Buell at last had all his troops collected. 8 divisions, with an overall strength of 55,000 men, were posted along a 6-mile front. His latest information was that Hardee was definitely at Perryville with 2 divisions. What else might be there he did not know, but for the present all was suspiciously quiet in that direction. At any rate, the Federal fist was clenched and ready to strike. This time, though, it was Buell's turn to be beaten to the punch, with results a good deal more costly than the loss of a few spare pools of brackish water. What would be lost now was blood. Bragg had waited at Harrodsburg through the early morning hours, cocking an ear to catch the steady roar of guns 10 miles southwest, which would signify that the attack he had ordered was underway, but, hearing nothing, had ridden down to Perryville to see for himself the reason for delay. Arriving about 10 o'clock, he found Polk reconnoitering the high ground near the confluence of Doctor's Creek and Chaplain River. The three divisions were in line, from right to left, Buckner, Patton Anderson, and Cheatham, the latter posted near the town itself, while Wheeler's cavalry was off to the south, making a show of strength in that direction. Except for the occasional pop of an outpost rifle, a heavy silence overhung the field. Confronted by Bragg, who wanted to know why his orders to give the enemy battle immediately had not been carried out, Polk explained that he was convinced that most of Buell's entire army was gathering in his front. What was more, the Yankees had struck first. Consequently, he had called another council of war, and, in view of the great disparity of our forces, he and Hardee had decided to adopt the defensive offensive to await the movements of the enemy and to be guided by events as they were developed. In short, he did not regard last night's letter of instructions as a peremptory order to attack at all hazards, but that I should carry the instructions into execution as judiciously and promptly as a willing mind and sound discretion would allow. So he said then and later. However, he added that he had observed signs of activity here on the Federal left, and had decided to switch Cheatham's division to this flank in order to guard against being overlapped in this direction. If Bragg approved, he would convert this into an offensive as soon as the men were in position. Bragg did approve, emphatically, and Polk began to make his dispositions accordingly, massing Cheatham's and Buckner's divisions under cover of the woods beyond the confluence of the creek and river. They would be supported by two brigades from Anderson, whose remaining two brigades would make a simultaneous holding attack to the south and west, thereby discouraging any weakening of the enemy right to bolster the left when it was assailed. By 1 o'clock, apparently without Federal detection of what was going on behind the screen of trees, the Butternut troops were in assault formation, supported rank on rank by heavy concentrations of artillery. Soon afterward, Polk passed the word for both divisions to move forward. The attack could scarcely have come at a more propitious time. Propitious for the Confederates, that is. The bluecoats Polk had spotted late that morning on the Federal left were members of McCook's advance elements, reconnoitering for occupation of the position by his two divisions shortly after noon. While they were filing in, McCook himself rode back to report to Buell at Army headquarters, having explained to the commander of his lead division, Brigadier General J.S. Jackson, that he was to form a line of battle along the near bank of Chaplain River. Jackson was glad to hear this, for his men were thirsty after their dusty march. So was his senior brigade commander, Brigadier General William Terrell, whom he told to advance his skirmishers to the river bank as soon as he had his troops in attack formation. "I'll do it, and that's my water," Terrell said. He was a Union-loyal Virginian. In fact, he was the former cadet Sheridan had lunged at with a bayonet 10 years ago at the academy. Since then, they had shaken hands and agreed to forget their grievance. Sheridan was thankful ever afterwards that they had staged this reconciliation, for Terrell was dead within an hour of his arrival on the field. Cheatham and Buckner struck with tremendous force and all the added impact of surprise, emerging suddenly from the drowsy-looking woods in a roaring charge. Terrell's men were mostly green, and being taken thus while they were advancing toward their baptism of fire, they heard in the rebel yell the fulfillment of their dry-mouthed apprehensions. Jackson, who was with them when the blow fell, was killed by one of the first volleys. They wavered, then broke completely when a bullet cut down Terrell. Behind them, the other deploying brigades were also taken unawares. Some of the men fled at once under the shock. Others stood and fought, sometimes hand to hand. Steadily, though, they were thrown back, the massed Confederate batteries knocking down the stone walls and fences behind which the retreating Federals had sought refuge. A mile or more they were driven, losing 15 guns in the process. By the time McCook returned from the rear, he found his two divisions near demoralization and utter ruin staring him in the face. In this extremity, he called across the way for help from Gilbert. That general also had his hands full, however, or anyhow he thought so. He had repulsed Anderson's attack down the south bank of the creek, but he did not know how soon another would be launched or in what strength. Sheridan, from his advanced position on the left, could look across the intervening valley and see the Graybacks sweeping westward, driving McCook's troops before them. All he could do for the present was turn his guns in that direction, heaving shells into the flank of the gray columns as they crossed his line of fire. This threw them into considerable confusion and encouraged Gilbert to detach first one brigade, then another, to go to McCook's assistance. When they had left, he counterattacked with his right flank brigade and drove Anderson back on Perryville, capturing a 15-wagon ammunition train. But this was late in the day. Having advanced so far, the brigade commander put his batteries in position west of the town and, firing his shells across the rooftops, engaged some rebel guns on the opposite side until darkness put an end to the duel and relieved the terror of the civilians, who had crouched in their cellars and heard the projectiles arching overhead with a flutter as of wings. Such was Gilbert's contribution, and such was the contribution of his 20,000 men, who faced barely 2,500 Confederates, while McCook and his 12,500 were being mauled by nearly equal numbers, just beyond easy musket range on the left. Crittenden, on the right, with 22,500 men, contributed even less. In fact, he contributed nothing at all, being bluffed into immobility by Joe Wheeler's 1,200 horsemen and two guns. Thus it was that 16,000 rebels could successfully challenge 55,000 bluecoats, not more than half of whom were seriously engaged.